I got one more takeaway. Duke's got a spy.
Yes. That is mine. We need a national investigation into every single... We watched three Duke games. Every single... It was never on a normal timeout. Every single time there was a TV timeout, there was a kid from the end of Duke's bench dressed in their Duke gear who would sprint. Yeah. I have a picture of it. I will show you what he looks like. He is literally kneeling at center court at the scorer's table, staring, peering, making notes into the opposition's huddle every single television timeout.
You're now in the huddle with Coach Calls Timeout, the podcast that dissects the mind of a different basketball coach every episode. We uncover what makes them successful and how their story translates to your coaching journey. Let's unlock your team's potential together. Welcome to episode 27 of the Coach Calls Timeout podcast. Dan Jonker here. Today we're going to change it up a little bit. Myself and my two brothers, Brian and Brady, recently went to New York to watch the Big East and ACC championships. The Big East tournament was played at Madison Square Garden and the ACC tournament was at the Barclays Center in Brooklyn. Our trip went from Wednesday to Sunday and we managed to squeeze in 10 fantastic games. This podcast episode is going to talk about two things. We're going to discuss our trip, obviously, but we're going to do it in a way that also answers some Twitter questions that we received. Luckily for us, some of the questions are directly related to the scenarios we saw in the 10 games. So let's get right to it. On the first day of the trip, it was off to Madison Square Garden for the first round of the Big East tournament. First, we had St. John's against Georgetown, and the late game was Xavier and DePaul. One of the questions we often get on Twitter is about motivation. How do you motivate your players? Here at Coach Calls Timeout, we tend to focus on positivity. We know that that wins with players in the long run. It makes the game fun, and players who have fun become hardworking, creative, and high-energy teammates more often than not. It's also important for coaches to support their players. We witnessed an old-school rivalry-type game with St. John's and Georgetown. Let's jump into the conversation I had with my brothers about the coach of St. John's and NBA Hall of Famer Chris Mullin and how he used the situation to show his support for his players and get them fired up.
The Big East tournament, we had some fireworks.
That was old school Big East. That was a heated rivalry at the Garden, fired up crowd because of, St. John's, the local school, and St. John's and Georgetown go back 30 years in the rivalry in the Big East. So that was old school, and it was definitely a battle. Got very heated at the end there with Chris Mullin, the coach at St. John's, going after John Thompson the third a little bit at Georgetown there near the end of the game, to the point where things had to be separated and the players had to hold the coaches back. It was pretty interesting.
I mean, obviously the emotions were high at that point in the game, and there was a hard foul from the Georgetown guy, but I felt like Chris Mullin may have been manufacturing, trying to get his team going a little bit, and maybe started that argument to get the crowd a little more fired up and add some fire to the rivalry for future as well.
Yeah, that's a good point, though. What, as a coach, what are the different types of tactics within a game that you use to try and maybe get your players a little bit more interested or engaged? It was a point in the game where St. John's needed a bit of a boost, and that definitely brought it. But as a coach, I mean, there are different times in a game where you think, geez, we don't have it, or they're lacking energy, and it's almost something that you have to provide to find a way to get the guys going. Sometimes it'll be getting after an official maybe a little bit. Sometimes you end up taking a technical in a spot almost intentionally or intentionally just to do the same kind of thing. And at that stage, it seemed like... like you said, it was a little bit manufactured. Although I think once the crowd got into it, it might have fueled Chris Mullin a little bit, and it went from manufactured to this is on.
Going to give up opportunities at the rim. Intentional. And a little pushing and shoving going on. Intentional. Chris Mullin on the floor. And now John Thompson III with some words. Whoa! Boy, is this like
this
the
reminds
old...
you of the old days.
Wow, we're going back in time. A lot of woofing unnecessarily.
Between the two coaches.
Yeah, exactly. They got a technical on Chris now.
Now fans standing.
By the way, St. John's won that game 74-73. Another question we get is about managing players' fouls, and this situation happened in the same game. When do you sit a player, and for how long if they're in foul trouble? So we had a long trip into New York, and we missed the first few minutes of the St. John's Georgetown game. Partway through the first half, Brady noticed that one of Georgetown's best players, LJ Peak, hadn't been in the game yet. We just assumed he was injured. It wasn't until we finally looked it up on our phones that we realized he picked up two quick fouls before we got there. Let's pick up the discussion from that
Peak
point.
LJ Peak was missing, and we were wondering if he was injured, and Brady, you kept saying, "Where is he? Where is he?" Apparently, he got two quick fouls.
He's by far their best player. I've seen Georgetown play three or four times this year, and LJ Peak stands out. And he came in the second half and he took over right away and kept Georgetown in the game basically the whole time. He had 24 points that game in 26 minutes. He didn't sit in the second half at all. Why take him out with two fouls 6 minutes into the game and not put him back in? He didn't pick up another foul until maybe 2 minutes left in the game. So he sat there for 14 minutes on the bench without playing, and then they finally put him back in to start the second half, and he doesn't pick up his third till 2 minutes left. So what's the line, and when do you decide to sit a guy in an important game like that?
I think it's very much obviously a coaching or philosophical thing that's changes or is different between coach to coach. Me personally, one of my three rules of life is don't worry about things that haven't happened. And I think that falls into that category. As coaches, we tend to worry about what hasn't happened in that situation. So you're worried about Peak picking up a third foul. And as you said, in reality, he never got his third foul, or it never, foul trouble never became a factor in the second half. And meanwhile, here he was 14 minutes sitting on the bench in the first half. And Georgetown maybe could have put that game away in the first half. And they never had that, you know, they had their foot on St. John's throat but couldn't put them away. And that extra score and your best player being out there a little more might have been able to push them over the top. Instead, St. John's hangs around. They end up winning it in the end.
It's a trust factor, too. I mean, he's a junior. If you can't trust him to not commit more fouls or to play differently, play with an awareness that he has two fouls, I'm fine with sitting him for the like 5 or 6 minutes.
I agree.
You need to put him back in there.
Yeah, he got the two fouls so quickly that I think you had to sit him.
Yeah.
But to just leave him there for 14 straight minutes in the first half, that's not something I do. Again, I'm not going to worry about something that hasn't happened. So, and like you said, I think it is a trust thing too, where you got to be able to trust your junior, your best player. I mean, if you can't go over to him and say, "Hey, buddy, be smart. You got two already. If you pick up a third, you're definitely sitting here."
Yeah, even if it means like a couple times he just kind of does the Olé defense and you give up a bucket or two, like it's better to have him on the court than...
Absolutely. I mean, I go back to when Hank Gathers died for Loyola Marymount, and they got to the tournament, and Bo Kimble was far and away their best player, and they had a fantastic run in that tournament, fueled by the team and his energy in particular on Hank's memory. But Bo Kimble in the one NCAA tournament game had four fouls in the first half, and he played every minute of that game, and they just left him out there. And ultimately, he was fantastic in the difference in winning that game. So I think Georgetown really suffered with Peak sitting as much as he did.
What are you going to remember most about that game, Brady?
The crowd was fantastic there in the last 8 minutes in the Garden. Like we said earlier, St. John's, Georgetown, old school rivalry. Doesn't get much better than that. I mean, it was pretty awesome.
Right?
It's just different. I mean, the electricity in that building is very, very different. And this was a Wednesday night, day one of the Big East tournament. between two teams that are fierce rivals, but neither had any real serious aspirations of winning that tournament. And yet the energy and the fuel in that building was amazing.
Yeah, that's my takeaway too. Is both teams right now, are, as it stands, are 14 and 18. So they aren't knocking on the bubble here of the tournament, and the crowd was fantastic. It was a lot of fun.
Day two of the trip was a big one for me and Brady. We're big North Carolina fans, and this was going to be the first time we've ever seen them live. We were off to the Barclays Center to watch the four quarterfinal games of the ACC tournament. In one of the games, Duke against Louisville, we saw something that ties into a question we've helped the coach with in the past. What's the best way to manage your timeouts? I'll paint the picture real quickly. Duke's up three, 20 seconds to go in the game. Louisville has the ball and one timeout left. The play they were running was not working out, and it was clear that they needed to be rescued. Now, not every league allows coaches to stop the play with a timeout, but in the NCAA, timeouts can be called. Let's pick up the discussion there.
Always kind of looked at each other and like, why didn't Patino call a timeout there? Bri, what kind of strategies do you have down the stretch? Obviously, they had a play that they wanted to run. It was clear, and Louisville still had timeouts left. It was clear nothing good was coming out of that.
It was very clear.
Unless it was a backwards, sideways, some kind of miracle shot.
Yeah. I mean, he's a Hall of Fame coach, so to criticize or, you know, second guess him is difficult. But I think we've all been there as coaches where, like you said, it became very obvious nothing good was going to come out of that. And at that point, in the Federation rules, where you can call timeout, the guy was actually dribbling 6 feet away from Patino, so all the focus was right there. To call that timeout, the referees are already looking. It wouldn't have been any effort to call that timeout and draw something up. Having said that, when you ask as a general philosophy, especially in FIBA, it doesn't leave you much choice, but I think in a lot of cases, your best opportunity to score at the end of a game like that is without calling the timeout. It's with pushing the ball at people and creating on the fly, because the defense generally isn't set up. They haven't been able to sit down and talk about what they want to do defensively and get organized. I think you get great opportunities off of attacking like that and not calling the timeout. But again, having, repeating what you said, it was clear nothing good was going to come of it. And at that point, I think he needed to call a timeout.
Yeah.
He didn't. They don't score. Duke moves on.
Sometimes you have to call an audible. Yes. The play isn't going to work.
Yes.
The defense was all over them.
Yes. And as coaches, I mean, look, I lose sleep all the time. I rarely lose any sleep after winning. You sleep a little bit easier. But when you lose like that, I mean, he'd be up all night thinking of all the different things that he could have done differently as a coach that might have made that little bit of difference. When you lose a close game like that, there's so many opportunities that you've had and let go that one, I'm sure he's sitting at home thinking, I should have called timeout.
3-point game, 22 seconds. Snyder should try to get it all the way to the rim. It's taking too much time here. Way too much time. And Mathang shouldn't be handling it.
Snyder has to step in, leaves it short. Kennard's got it, and Louisville has to foul again with just 4 seconds left.
What a poor offensive possession for Louisville. To give the ball to Mango Mathiang, all of a sudden you got nowhere to go.
From the four games that we watched at the Barclays Center for the ACC tournament, Braid, what's your one thing you're going to remember from that day?
Well, as North Carolina fans, it's tough to say, but Duke has three really, really good players, and they're not just shooters. They can score. Like, they get to the basket. They're just really good. And Jason Tatum especially he's going to be an excellent pro. He's something else to watch in person. He's so much control of his body, and he makes so many good decisions out there. And, you know, you give him a little bit of time, and he's going to be really special. He's a very good basketball player.
Yeah, Bri, when we were watching that game, you even said, We've talked about this in the past on how few great point guards actually win the NBA championship. You know, there's Isaiah Thomas, Steph Curry now, but it doesn't happen very often. And obviously with this draft class, there's the four guys, point guards that are projected to be top 4 or 5. And you're saying with that performance, if I'm picking number one, I'm picking Tatum.
Yeah, I mean, after seeing him the entire weekend, in the NBA, you need a wing scorer, and that guy that can get his own shot, the guy that can score over people and through people, that can take over games at the end of the game. And as you pointed out, in the last 30 years, probably Isaiah and Curry are the only two point guards that you could say at the time of winning was a top 5 point guard in the league, with maybe the exception of Tony Parker in his early year. And yet, if you go back through the teams that have won and try and find a team that didn't have a 3 or a 4 that wasn't capable of scoring, you almost can't. And to me, I'd pick him number one. I think he's really, really good. And the more we saw him all weekend live, I mean, he just makes such a difference in so many different ways.
So my takeaway would be, as a North Carolina fan, I'm going to talk about North Carolina. Their bigs are big, Meeks and Hicks, and they play so well together. They have their little high-low game. They see each other. They find each other. And the one thing that they do really well is they work early to get their positioning. They don't wait until the wing has the ball, or they don't wait till the ball's in the high post to start battling for position. They're battling beforehand because they know they get that little extra 1 second, and it gets them a little bit deeper down in the post, and they just seem to dominate down there when they work well together. So, Bri, what was your takeaway from the Thursday?
People who get all excited for the NCAA tournament. I mean, it is exciting. It's really neat to sit down on a Thursday afternoon and say, let's go. This is the first 4 days in particular, so many games and whatever. But if you're really a college basketball fan, this is the week of college basketball. I mean, when you have conference tournaments where teams all across the country are more evenly matched and every game is more competitive than you'd see in the NCAA tournament, you know, you're not getting a 1 and a 16 and a 2 and a 15. You're getting teams that battle all year long, rivalries. And what my takeaway was, we saw, you know, North Carolina, Duke, Louisville, Florida State. You know, those are 4 of the top 10 or 12 teams in the country.
Notre Dame
and Virginia all on the same day. I mean, you're not going to get that in an NCAA tournament. You know, you could argue that we saw Final Four caliber teams, or Final Four level teams, you know, in the quarterfinals of the ACC. So that's my takeaway.
Now we're into the third day of our trip. Both the Big East and the ACC finals were scheduled to go at the same time. Maybe the biggest mistake we made on our trip was to pre-purchase some of the tickets, and we already had in hand the Big East semifinal tickets at MSG. We underestimated how easy it would be to get scalper tickets for under face value. Well, when I say easy, I mean I stood there while Brian negotiated and did all the work. Okay, so one problem. We have the Big East tickets, but as I said, 2 of us are North Carolina fans, and they were about to play Duke in the ACC semifinal going on at the same time. Obviously, we couldn't be that close and not go to a Carolina-Duke game, so we called an audible, sold our Big East tickets, and headed over to witness Duke versus North Carolina. In our discussion, we get into a topic we've mentioned before in our basketball coaching roadmap episodes. Finding an assistant coach who's able to see things without getting emotional can be a huge asset to your team.
So we couldn't be in New York and not go to a Duke-Carolina game. Didn't work out the way that me and Brady wanted, but we still had some great basketball. And the second game was Notre Dame-Florida State, which is also a great game. What are your takeaways from that night, Brian?
Well, experiencing the Duke-North Carolina rivalry for the first time, even though it wasn't at Chapel Hill or at Cameron, it was still electric. And I'm going to guess in some ways maybe even better from the standpoint that the crowd was, I'm not going to say split, because I think there was more North Carolina fans in the building, but I'd say it was 60-40 North Carolina, and if you go to either of those other buildings in the home court, you're not going to get that many visitors in there. So it was pretty heated all night, and the electricity there back and forth, every run, regardless of which team was making it, had people on their feet. It was a great basketball game.
Brady, what's your takeaway?
In the North Carolina Duke game, it was fantastic, like Brian said. The one thing I noticed is that in the first half, North Carolina is just so much bigger than Duke. And Kennedy Meeks, I think, had 15 and 10 in the first half, and Hicks had 8 or 9 points, and they just kept feeding the post all game long, and Duke couldn't stop it. And then in the second half, they just went away from it. They quit going to it, and it really allowed Duke to get back into the game. North Carolina was up quite a bit there at one point, and then Duke went on, you know, a 10-12-2, 12-4 run that got them back in the game, got the crowd on their side with about 5 minutes left in the game. North Carolina just went away from what was working for them in the first half and the second half there, and it really hurt them down the stretch.
I think it's important. I mean, you bring that point up, Brady. It's funny, we're sitting in the stands, and I think, you know, we're commenting on that constantly throughout the second half. It's, geez, they've gone away from the bigs. They've gone away from the bigs. Their advantage is the bigs. They kick the crap out of them with the bigs. And we're sitting there on the sidelines in the stands, unemotional, you know, watching it. You guys are a little more emotional because you actually cared who won. But I'm sitting there watching it with no emotion, thinking these things. As a coach, if you can find an assistant with a really calm demeanor that's able to sit and process and analyze things without getting caught too much into the emotion of the game, I think it's important. Because somebody needs to say something at that point that, hey, we've gotten away from what was working, guys. Instead of just the emotion of it all, and then after we're the game, you look back at each other and go, what could we have done differently? And say, Jesus, Meeks and Hicks and those guys never touched the ball in the second half. You know, that needs to happen during the game. And sometimes as a head coach especially, you're so emotionally involved and you're worrying about who's coming next and who's going in and should we change this defense? Should we do this? Should we do that? That sometimes you lose sight of certain things. And it's hard to believe because it seems so obvious. But boy, like you said, Brady, they gave away a huge advantage they had.
The same thing happened. Maybe it's more of a credit to Duke. They took it away because the same thing happened in the Louisville game the night before. Louisville was dominating in the paint. I think they had put up a stat that points in the paint was like,
it's like 30-10 at one.
30-10 at one in the first half, the beginning of the second half, and then Louisville just stopped going down low as well. So maybe Duke, it's a credit to Duke's. Duke also switched up their defense.
Yes, Duke. The change in the Louisville game the day before was that Duke went zone there. It almost like Krzyzewski kept it in his back pocket, and when they needed a run in the second half, they threw the 2-3 at Louisville for the first time. And Louisville never adjusted.
They were lost.
No, they sat there and jacked threes the rest of the way. And they went away from the inside game. And that allowed Duke to get stops and runouts. And the change in defense really won the game that day for Duke.
Another quick takeaway is that Florida State-Notre Dame game, where Florida State struggled the whole game to get into it. Similar circumstance. They are just so much bigger. Like, Notre Dame plays Bonzi Colson at center, and he's 6'5", 6'6". And Florida State's over there with two or three guys that are 7-1, 7-4, like, and they didn't play them in the first half. They didn't start them. They didn't do any of that. And then in the second half, when they were down 15, they decided to start playing the big guys. Well, now it's too late. You can't trade twos for threes all game long when you're down 15 points. I mean, that 7-4 guy, although his hands were pretty bad, like, he's so much bigger, you could just throw him the ball and he's at the rim already, and he's got a foot advantage on the next tallest guy on Notre Dame, and they didn't take advantage of it.
Yeah, so you talked about that with North Carolina going away from what was working. In the case of the Florida State game, it was a decision made before the game
even started. Abandoned it before it started.
Before the game even started. He changed his starting lineup and took the bigs out of the starting lineup.
Yeah.
So that was a group of coaches that got together and felt their best way to play Notre Dame was to almost go down to Notre Dame's level and, hey, we've got better athletes as well, so we're going to go the same size as you are with our better athletes and we're going to beat you. Where from, you know, a neutral observer's standpoint, watching them the day before against really a similar Virginia Tech team, because Virginia Tech was very small.
Yeah.
Florida State just dominated them with the big guys. And we sat there and watched and thought, yeah, you know what? On the defensive end, Florida State was going to take some hits against Notre Dame playing big because Notre Dame has so many good perimeter players and shooters with Vastori and Farrell and even Beecham and
Luger.
They're gonna score a bit from the perimeter, and it's gonna hurt you. But on the offensive end, they would have caused so much of a nightmare. I think they were too worried that Notre Dame's best big guy, Colson, was so versatile he could step out, make the three, he could put it on the floor. And they, when they go big with their 7-4 and their, you know, 7-2 Ojo and that they were not gonna be able to defend that. But boy, they decided right before the game even started not to start their big guy and try and play their 6'11", you know, more mobile guy. And they gave away their advantage before the game even started.
Before we get to the last night of our trip, I'm going to jump in quickly to tell you a bit about us. Coach calls timeout. The three of us you hear in this episode, myself and my brothers Brian and Brady, run Coach Calls Timeout. This is not a full-time job for any of us. It's a side project fueled by our love for basketball. And we want to help as many coaches as we possibly can. So, if you're a coach and you need a few plays, drills, or practice plans, check us out at coachcallstimeout.com. Let me tell you what makes us different than all the other basketball coaching resources out there. All our plays and drills are in video format, no still shots, so they show the exact timing required to be successful. Our plays and drills can be downloaded directly to your laptop, phone, or tablet. All the videos are small enough files that you can send them to your players to use as a study guide, or you can use them during practices or timeouts. Increase your team's efficiency and effectiveness. There's good news for you as a podcast listener. You can take advantage of our special offer. Go to coachcallstimeout.com right after this episode. When you're signing up to become a member, just use the coupon code PODCAST, and you'll receive a free 7-day trial to sample every video and practice plan we have to offer. Let's get back to Saturday night, the Big East and ACC Tournament Finals. The schedule makers did a great job for each of the conference finals on our last night of the trip. First, we made our way to Madison Square Garden for the Big East Final and had just enough time to watch a few minutes of the Villanova celebration, and off we went to the Barclays Center for the ACC Final, Duke versus Notre Dame. And that game did not disappoint. We also learned a few things watching Coach K. First and most obvious, he knows his players better than we do. And second, he did a fantastic job of coaching them and managing their playing time. Oh, and there also might need to be a national inquiry into the Duke program and their use of a not-so-secret spy. Listen in and you'll understand what I'm talking about.
Villanova's damn tough. Yeah. That's my takeaway. They're not... Talk about a team that's not necessarily big. But boy, they defend, man. They're tough mentally, physically. They just wear you out. And I think you pointed out when we were there, the most impressive thing about how well they play defensively is they don't foul. They play defense without fouling. Yep. And they're just tough, really tough.
Let's get to the ACC final. At the Barclays Center, Notre Dame, Duke. Fantastic. Probably maybe the best game of the 10 that we saw this week, I would think.
Yeah,
just because of the stakes and the crowd and the guy sitting in front of us, the Notre Dame fan punching the air constantly. It was a fantastic game. Well played. Everything was high level. What are you going to remember most from that, Brady?
I mean, Duke's really good, but Notre Dame's tough too. Like Matt Farrell, he's really tiny, but wow, he's really good. He's got a quick burst. I think he kind of plays a little bit like Kyle Lowry myself. He's got a nice little jumper, makes great decisions. They could be tough come tournament time. I wouldn't want to play them. I mean, they're a really good team. Very well coached. Probably one of the best coached teams in the tournament, because when you look at their roster in comparison to a Duke and a North Carolina, they don't have the same level of talent, but he gets the most out of what he has. His players are fantastic.
Bri, what was your takeaway from that game? What are you going to remember most?
From a player standpoint, Tatum again, I thought he had a big block in about a minute and a half, 2 minutes to go there. It came weak side. Weak side helped defense, big block, grabbed the rebound, went coast to coast, scored. Then of course he had the big dunk at the end that sealed the game as well and got fouled. But it's funny because I had turned to Brady with about maybe 8 minutes left and said, geez, Tatum really hasn't done much today other than a big putback dunk in the first half. And the last 5 minutes of the game, he basically won the game for him. He ended up scoring 8 or 10 points in the last 5 minutes and really made the difference on both ends of the floor. So a lot of kudos to the freshman. But
both teams seem to just kind of play a free-flowing type of basketball. Yes. You know, there wasn't set plays, and Coach K even said that in his speech or in his interview afterwards with Jay Billis, that in the last, how many did you say?
The last 10 minutes, we never called
a play. Last 10 minutes, he didn't even call a play. He just let them go, and he felt that that's, kids don't get tired when they feel like it's their own thing that they're doing, that they're running, and it's their ideas. And you could tell. I mean, that's my takeaway, is the, it seems to be a new thing in the last few years on that penetration. They'll call a ball screen or something, and on the penetration, it's almost instinctively, guys just throw it back to where they were before, backwards to that opposite wing, and it's always open. And it's just, it's a constant kind of cycle around and around and around, and it just keeps happening and happening. And Duke does a fantastic job of it. It's nice that they have a shooter that catches it every time. My second takeaway, we watched Matt Jones play. This was the third game of the week. He did not hit a single shot in his 75 minutes that he played in the three games that we saw until the last three, that was the dagger. And I had just said 2 minutes before that, why do you even have Jones out there? The guy does nothing. He doesn't even shoot anymore, let alone hit shots. And sure enough, they kicked it out to him and he hit that big three.
But the bigger point related to all this is, with about 8 minutes to go in the game, 10 minutes to go in the game, he took Grayson Allen out.
Yeah.
And put Jones back in.
And left him.
And you thought it was going to be a rest.
Yeah.
Although, I don't know if you noticed, I watch the coaches all the time. And when Grayson Allen came out, he went by Krzyzewski. And Krzyzewski put his hand out and gave him five. But Krzyzewski squeezed his hand and pulled him back.
Yeah.
And Krzyzewski said something to him. And Grayson just nodded and went and sat down.
Well, he was awful for that 3 or 4 minute stretch before that.
He really was. Yeah. And so he saved him from himself almost by taking him out.
Yeah.
And then the lineup that was out there did a decent job, so he didn't put him back in. But if
I think
he also
put him in the last minute or 30 seconds.
He put him in for the free throws the last 30 seconds. That's it. Yeah. When the clock was stopped to shoot free throws, it was an obvious fouling situation. He put him back in. That's the only time, though.
Yeah.
And the other thing I watched, though, as a coach, I watched body language a lot. And not only did Grayson Allen accept whatever it was that Krzyzewski said to him, he shook his head, nodded, they made eye contact. He went and sat down, and I watched Allen for the last 3 or 4 or 5 minutes of that game. He cheered as loud as anybody did on the bench.
Yeah.
And if you get a chance to see the footage, because I know the highlights are from over our head, so it's down at the Duke bench. When Jones hit that three, if you watch the highlights, Grayson Allen was the first guy that jumped out of his seat to applaud the making of the shot. That goes a long way. You know, that group's going to be scary, I think, next week.
They are.
I got one more takeaway. Duke's got a spy.
Yes. That is my, we need a national investigation into every single, we watched three Duke games, every single, it was never on a normal timeout. Every single time there was a TV timeout, there was a kid from the end of Duke's bench dressed in their Duke gear who would sprint. I have a picture of it. I will show you what he looks like. He is literally kneeling at center court at the scorer's table, staring, peering, making notes into the opposition's huddle every single television timeout. He is there before the horn even goes half the time. I have no idea what he's looking for. I think we determined that he just writes the five guys that are sitting in the chairs.
But I don't know the advantage because you already know the five guys.
So he writes a note and then he runs back into the huddle and hands the note to a coach. So they're cheating. They're doing something. There's no way this should be allowed. It's cheating. I have pictures of this.
I don't know.
I have a video of this guy sprinting out. I'm sending it into the ACC committee.
I don't know what was going on there, but I don't know the advantage. Maybe in the TV timeout, you don't have to report your subs.
Right. Maybe
I don't know. And he's
But what's the advantage? He's giving them the note at the end of the huddle. What's the advantage?
We got 3 minutes after the huddle's over to talk, so...
Yeah, but those guys are... Everybody's already standing out there waiting for the commercials to be over. I don't know what the advantage is on it. I just know it was cheating.
I don't know if it's cheating.
I'm a Carolina fan. It was... Something's going on there.
So, I mentioned this, okay? At the same time, it just... Thinking about ethics and coaching. I don't know if the guy's cheating or whether it was unethical or not. These are Carolina fans. But... I saw a high school game there right before we came on this trip, and I saw something I've never seen ever. And that was one of the high school teams, one of their assistant coaches sat complete opposite corner to their bench in the bleachers in the front row and coached from the bleachers in the front row his team on defense in the first half because their bench is at the opposite end. And he screamed and yelled about Cutter coming. This guy's coming. Watch that. Do that. He coached from the front row on the opposite side of the bleachers in the opposite corner of their bench. And I don't think there's any rule against that, but I've never seen it ever.
So did he go back to his bench the second half?
It was the second half. He was on our side the second half.
Because the offense goes the other way in the first half. So it was the second half. And I've never seen it before. And it was more than extremely annoying for the fans. They wanted to kill the guy. But ethically, I don't know. I'm sure it didn't cross any rule book rules. But ethically, I don't know. I've never seen it. It was so obvious.
If you're a parent of the other team, you almost have to go and sit with him and just drown out his noise with your own noise.
Well, and you're almost asking for a fight at that point. And that's sort of what was... brewing because, he's saying stuff about individual, this guy's coming through, let him shoot, do this, do that.
Yeah.
And of course, the let him shoot, that guy makes a couple threes and his parents are all right into it now.
Yeah.
I'd never seen it before. Anyways, so this Duke guy who's running in the timeouts and coaching from the other side of the floor, I think those are ethical things and I'm not sure, I'm not sure where I stand on either of them, to be honest.
One's ethical, one's a cheat.
There's even one time the Notre Dame, the very first huddle, I thought, all right, Notre Dame finally figured it out. They had every one of their assistants stand between that kid and the huddle and talk beforehand. But then as soon as they went into the huddle, because the kid was like on his feet looking around them and trying to see. And then finally when the coaches went into the huddle, then he got on his one knee perch and started making his notes and that's the other takeaway. Duke fans love Grayson Allen and everyone else despises him. I've never seen a love hate like that since we were at the Air Canada Center when Vince Carter played against the Raptors in the playoffs, and they chanted constantly against him. But that's tough because you're a kid. You're not a professional athlete.
Yeah, it's really tough. You can certainly make the argument that he's done a lot of it to himself. And I'm sure Coach K's worked hard with him on that. But it's almost like every little thing he does now is magnified. And it's to the point where everybody just, you don't hear boo like that. And he's a 20-year-old kid or whatever he is. Like it's crazy. He played damn well on the weekend, though.
You made history in a number of different ways, but one of them, with all the injuries you've had, your team won 4 games in 4 days. That's never happened before. First of all, our guys are in real good condition, and we practice a lot less than we did a long time ago. And our guys have good hearts. And really, Jay, at the end, last 10 minutes of the game, we didn't call one play. We just told them, you make plays. And I think when you give ownership to a team, they don't get tired because it's theirs. They're not playing for anybody else. They're playing for them. But congratulations to you. Congratulations to the 2017 ACC Tournament Champions.
There you have it. Thanks for sharing our road trip with us. One of my favorite things to do during the 10 games we watched was to watch the coaches. There's a lot you can learn from coaches just by watching how they respond to adversity, or how they motivate their players, or how they deal with the refs.
It was a lot of fun watching guys like Coach K, Jay Wright, Roy Williams, Rick Pitino, and Mike Bray. I loved how active they are throughout the game, constantly getting feedback from their assistants and communicating with their players. It was definitely a trip we'll always remember, even though North Carolina didn't come away with the ACC championship. By the way, the Duke spy picture can be found in the show notes at coachcallstimeout.com/27. If anybody knows what's going on there, send us a message on Twitter at coachcallstime. And one last thing, obviously we recorded this before the NCAA tournament, but man, our prognostication skills are horrible. I think we had Villanova, Duke, Notre Dame, and Florida State all making a deep run. Clearly we were way off. Did this episode remind you of a coach you've had or a basketball experience you've shared with someone? If so, we'd love to hear about it. You can go to coachcallstimeout.com/stories to share your story. We're looking for stories about coaches who are creating fantastic memories for their players. Help give them the recognition that they deserve and possibly get their story told on this podcast. Again, you can go to coachcallstimeout.com/stories to share your story. If you enjoyed what you heard, we'd appreciate if you could rate us on iTunes or tell someone else about the show. Everything we've talked about today can be found in our show notes at coachcallstimeout.com/27. We'll be back again in 2 weeks with another episode. Our next episode will be the last one before we take a podcast break for the off season. By the way, you can check us out on Twitter. Our handle is @coachcallstime. See you in a couple weeks.
So next year, we're off to Vegas for a road trip, right? Is that what we decided?
Maybe we'll do the Pac-12 next year. Pac-12 in the WAC.
Get some California sun instead of New York freezing weather.
Although Las Vegas is in Nevada, but sure.
Oh, I thought you said Pac-12. Oh.
They play in Vegas.
Oh, do they? Yeah. Okay, I'll leave that out anyway.